This is Dr. Jennifer Jones with the Secret Life of Neurologists podcast, returning to you after a long meandering summer hiatus. It's all too familiar how an intended month off can easily turn into two, and from there, way leads on to way. But we are back because doing neurology in a big, busy hospital brings up things worth discussing and exploring. And with cooler and maybe quieter days around the corner, I'm ready to jump back in. So, just before we dove into the deep end of the summer, I grabbed my friend and colleague, Dr. Elaine Chan, to talk about delivering bad news to families. Don't get me wrong, she's an excellent surgeon. It's just that a trauma surgeon, like a neurohospitalist, often finds herself encountering patients and their families in tragic circumstances. And although giving and, for that matter, receiving bad news is a part of every life at some point, no one gets taught how to do it well. Dr. Chan has done some thinking about it, though, and I know from the experience of sharing patients with her that she has an easy and clear communication style that families appreciate and respond well to. She's authentic and honest with what she knows and what she doesn't, and so I thought she'd be a good colleague and friend to talk to about the process of breaking bad news.
So I'm a board-certified trauma surgeon. I also am board-certified in surgical critical care. I did my surgery residency in New York City, followed by fellowship in trauma at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, and then critical care in Miami. And my first job was in Philadelphia at a knife and gun club called Temple University Hospital.
So you got your chops there.
That's right. Yeah.
And then we've shared many patients in the ICU.
All the time.
And we've had encounters that... Yeah. When we have to deliver bad news to patients, so in the ICU, when you and I are overlapping, tends to be brain injury, TBI, or ICH. So first, let me just ask you, when you're faced with having to break bad news, do you have a standard template, or are you sort of assessing each family, you know, sort of what they're capable of processing or...
Yeah, so it's really interesting that we're talking about this now, because I recently gave a... talk on this that I plagiarized from my good partner, Red Hoffman. So shout out to her. She also has a podcast, Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Yep. There's a ask, tell, ask template. And what that means is asking the patients or their loved ones what their understanding, first of all, is of the situation. Because I think before you start telling what it is, it's good to kind of get to know where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And so I think medical literacy is a big one, kind of just gauging your audience, basically, and reading the room. And then telling, like, you know, when you break bad news, oftentimes in the palliative care world, we say you got to fire a warning shot. And so that would be oftentimes you'll say, I have bad news, you know, so that they're kind of prepared for it mentally. Once you deliver the bad news, silence is the most important part that follows that. And I think as healthcare providers, number one, we were never taught how to break bad news, right?
Right. I was going to ask you if you had that in training
never,
at all.
Never.
I mean, or demonstrated, I guess, with your attendings, but
not really.
Right.
I mean, maybe like I had some great attendings that like I could emulate, but that's about it. There was no formal training in it. And I think that still is embedded in our medical care system where we still don't teach it, you know, formally, which is kind of ironic because it's probably one of the most important parts of our job. Mm-hmm. And also one of the most nerve-wracking parts of our job is to break bad news. And then after you deliver the bad news, you usually follow it with kind of asking them how they've been able to cope with previous traumas or previous tragedies or previous bad news to see what works for them, because it has to be individualized to that person and everyone's different on how they cope.
So, and a lot of times people will volunteer that type of thing, like, oh, I've been through this with my mother or whatever.
Right.
But you'll literally ask them, have you ever had any similar experience?
Right.
And if they say no, then where do you go from there?
If they say no, typically I think there's a reflex in us to, and this is a mistake that I've learned now that I didn't realize before as I dug deeper into breaking bad news, is that we tend to offer a silver lining or some kind of future-oriented goal, like everything's going to be fine, or like one that comes to mind is a therapist / author by the name of Megan Devine, and she wrote a book that everyone should read called It's Okay to Not Be Okay. Mm-hmm. Her experience was with losing her husband suddenly in a tragic accident. Mm-hmm. And she really talked about that journey and how everyone kept saying to her, you'll find somebody else. It's like, that's not what she needs to hear.
Right.
But we, even in the healthcare setting, we'll say, oh, you know, you just lost your son, but you have a great community. You know, you're supported. That's not what they want to hear.
Yeah.
So like we have to train ourselves to just you know, be in their pain and be okay with that.
Yeah.
And that's where that silence and just like providing them the space to just be that way is really important. There's no words that are needed. I mean, literally, it's just being present and compassionate without feeling like you need to fix something.
And sometimes I'll say, this is just going to be a long road.
That's right.
Like, and so, it's not going to be easy.
Right. And there's no time stamp on grief, right?
Well, and so I think there's definitely times when families are more equipped. And I think, I don't know that I've learned that model of
ask, tell, ask,
mm-hmm. but I think I've acquired that just intuitively.
Right.
Because I've probably learned the hard way that I've walked in before and said, well, your husband has had a massive hemorrhage and it's unsurvivable. And I've just come out with that. I'm not talking about recently, but maybe in training, what have you. And then you kind of learn that, like, no, you need to kind of say, well, what do you know about has happened?
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of inform them from there.
Yeah, I think you have to set the stage.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to not walk into a room with an agenda either.
Yeah.
And I've made this mistake before where I'll go in and I'll say, oh, I need to get a code status at minimum of DNR.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think they can sense that. I think you have to build a rapport with the family. Let's say it's not something like dramatically sudden, tragic, like a loss of somebody like right away, but you know it's not going to end well.
Yeah.
So I think in those kind of instances, you really want to build this relationship with the loved ones or the patient and kind of like earn their trust in a bit and not feel like you're trying to, you know, do something on your to-do list.
Yeah.
And because they will sense that and then they'll back away. And then
well,
you won't be able to.
Well, definitely that happens in... I have definitely had that experience of feeling a little caught between what all the consulting or all the services caring for the patient know to be true. Say, for example, suffered a terrible hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. They're not going to recover. It's looking bad. And everything in the notes saying like, well, depending on prognosis, but this looks bad, right? And cardiology is involved, critical care. Everybody's kind of like, well, probably we're not going to do anything, but you know, neurology is going to talk about the prognosis. And then in neurology, we know that, you know, you can't say anything, particularly if they've been hypothermic, you can't say anything definitive for an extraordinarily long time, right?
Yeah.
Like 72 hours at the earliest if they're not hypothermic, and who really knows if they were hypothermic. So then you've just got these potential days of you being the one going like, yeah, I know it's probably bad, but I can't really know that, so I can't say it yet. And it's so hard to be in that position. It also feels a little, it's like the typical thing is like when the person has myoclonus, maybe the scan, the CT when they came in is unremarkable, right? Because it always
usually
is initially.
Right.
But then they have, oh, maybe let's say they have pupils reacting, but no corneals, no posturing, no eye opening, and everything else looks bad. And they're having myoclonus. And then you're kind of like, I know that that is almost always a terrible thing. Their EEG is flat or burst suppression. But you just have to sit there and wait. And it feels, there's definitely a pressure, peer pressure, to move forward and be able to get the family to go ahead and accept this devastating thing. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. It's
and how do you manage that?
Yeah, I think that in trauma, especially neurological trauma, you know, for no pun intended, it's such a huge gray zone, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
truly.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is.
No,
and
it really is.
And I sometimes like really need to rely on, you know, neurologists to tell me like what is the prognosis, because sometimes when it's obvious, it's obvious, but when it's not, you just don't want to be the one to be saying there's absolutely no chance. Because I mean, half the times, let's face it, medicine, there is no certainty, right? There's so much variability and unpredictability. But when it's not obvious, it's like we had that patient that we shared where, you know, we really waited a week just to see if there was any progression.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes for the family's sake, they just need that time,
you
know, to wait, you know, and see if there's any hope. And I think it's
fair.
I think it's fair because, you know, shock and denial like takes a few days to, you know, even get over that. And then they just need some time to actually process it. So I think sometimes you do need to give them some time and you shouldn't rush it. And, you know, sometimes they need to earn that. They need to feel from you that you're not trying to rush that process either.
Well, and that's definitely where I think neuro is we are the people who have to say like, I know it's probably bad, but we're going to wait.
Right.
And it can sometimes feel a little bit of pressure because I do think most of the time I know that it's, you know, it's an unfortunate looking.
Right.
I guess I should say, you know, we don't know. That's why we have to have these conglomerate studies of massive, more patients than any one of us could ever know. But I haven't necessarily seen a person with myoclonus and all the other bad signs at 72 hours you know, come out. And then also if they're 85, you know, it's kind of like, even if they are going to be better in a year,
what's the quality of
life,
right?
Of recovery at 85 look?
Yeah. Because it's not just about surviving, mm-hmm. right? It's what does the survivorship look like?
Right.
And oftentimes, I think whenever we're having these conversations, we're always asking, like, what do they want to prioritize? Are they trying to prioritize quality or quantity? And right. invariably, they always say quality, right?
Right.
Because I think most people wouldn't want to live if their life it couldn't go back to the baseline
right.
of their functional status before they entered the hospital. But I think most people who've had, you know, 100% independence and then go through some, you know, tragic event to come out and not be that 100%, most people will have some kind of opinion on that, whether they want to go on. And I think the hardest times is when the patient can't speak for him or herself, though.
Right.
And you have loved ones who've never had that conversation have to make that call. I think that's
the other
tragic.
Thing I think is hard is that I've started to recognize is that almost everyone, when you say, well, what would they want? Like, let's say they don't have advanced directives.
Sure.
And then you say, well, what would they want? Well, they always said, you know, if there's a chance I can recover, then go ahead and, you know, save me. If it looks, you know, hopeless,
always.
Then just take me off. Well, right. Obviously.
Yeah.
But what about the 1,000 miles between
exactly.
recovering and not? Like, and so I usually say, like, well, what is it that would need to do? Can just sitting there in a wheelchair, being able to see your grandchildren be enough? Or is there potentially, you know, do they want to play the piano? You know, what would that be? And
right.
and that's where everybody needs to be specific. There's just that gray area that people are not equipped to deal with sometimes.
Yeah, I think culturally speaking, as a society, we shy away from the topics of death, right?
Mm-hmm.
We tend to just act like it's not going to happen, or there's a subconscious fear that it is going to happen, and we're worried that we're going to be suffering at the end. We tend to shy away from talking about it at all because we're
yeah.
like, oh, it's not going to happen. If there's one thing that anybody can get out of this conversation is that you need to have that conversation.
Yeah.
You need to have it while you can, because when something happens, which can happen anytime, any moment, you don't want to be guessing, and you certainly don't want that emotional burden.
And if you give your family specifics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because living well in advanced directives was one thing, right? And like you said, it's for that specific instance of vegetative state. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, what if your quality of life is seriously hindered? What
yeah.
if you're, you know, there's a scoring system, the palliative performance scale,
mm-hmm.
and it talks about, like, are they able to perform their ADLs? Are they able to, are they bedbound? Are they, you know, so it goes over specific things, like this is exactly what we're talking
right.
about. And oftentimes when that score falls a certain percentage, most people, it's a miserable life. And,
right.
you know, I have learned that it's not my job to qualify what quality of life means for someone else.
Well, that is what I was thinking about as another part of this conversation, because it's definitely possible that we underestimate the quality of life. And for example, I've seen studies about ALS patients who have chosen to be, when they're asked about quality of life, those few, I think it's less than 10%, but very few end up saying they want to be intubated and ventilated, but they are glad that they have.
Right.
They rarely, if ever, say that they wish they hadn't.
You mean the few that have gone
yeah.
that route?
Yeah, mm-hmm. they don't regret the decision, in other words, which I think we all think that we would not wish to be like that. But there is some meaning in that even.
Yeah, I think meaning
yes.
is different for everybody. I
mm-hmm.
think that's really the take-home point, is that we can't really impose our own preconceived notions of what quality of life is upon others.
Right, but we do, right?
We do.
We do. I mean,
we, do.
We see things
we do.
And we think,
like,
what,
no way.
What
yeah.
would that life be like? Or when people, maybe there's a little bit of ageism, you know, when there's 85-year-old who's
yep.
barely functioning to begin with. And
right.
then we think, like, why would you put them through this?
Right.
I mean, sometimes I think we think it seems cruel.
Yeah, I think
this.
It does in
yeah.
our eyes.
Yeah.
But in the family's eyes, that's what they have to feel like they've done everything for that patient.
Right. So let's talk about, too. So there are times when families are people that we can understand and identify with and, you know, understand what they're struggling with. And then there are times when there are families that are just seemingly incapable of absorbing or processing or whatever has happened in the families, making it a very difficult conversation. How do you deal with that when you're at odds with expectations from the family versus what you're having to deliver in terms of the news and expectations?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when the denial is severe, you kind of just have to take a step back and understand that you're not only supporting this patient, but you're supporting their loved ones, and give them space and give them time.
Yeah.
We just recently had a patient who was pretty much clinically brain dead, but the family just couldn't come around to it. And there was nothing we could do about it, right?
Yeah.
It was to a point where we had to get like the higher ups involved, basically, because we didn't know how to navigate through that.
Because I mean, I think at this point, technically, once we've declared brain death,
exactly.
We can just withdraw care.
Exactly. I mean, on paper, sure.
Right.
Know, but in reality, no.
Right.
In reality, you're calling risk. You're calling hospital administration because you're like, I don't know what to do.
That even works with billing.
Right.
Okay. That's cynical, but I'm just saying.
No, like, but that like, is, really, yeah, we didn't know what to do. It was
right.
It was such an ethical dilemma for us.
Well, and there are states, I just read this, that I find this fascinating and disturbing, but there are states where brain death can be declared and family has the right to refuse taking the ventilator and everything off. And then they can, you know, move them to somewhere, some facility, if they can find one, and sometimes flying them at great expense with all the, you know, medical support to some place that will support them. And they will continue to, you know, be supported until whatever complications occur down the road.
That's crazy.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the hardest ones that I've dealt with are high C-spine injuries.
Yeah,
you know, because like
be hard. Yeah.
We typically say, you know, if they have no motor function, you know, like they're quadriplegic, automatically, instinctively, we're like, why are you going to do this operation if it's not going to bring their motor function back?
Yeah,
and so I face this dilemma all the time, like in the ER, as to what to tell the family, because oftentimes what happens is that we end up doing the C-spine stabilization surgery,
mm-hmm.
and then 3-4 days later, they withdraw care. There's been a lot of that.
Yeah.
And so it just makes you wonder.
Is that what you find most people do with a high C-spine?
It depends.
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends on like their age. I would say the octogenarians, especially,
yeah.
I try my best to prevent that from even happening. Because I would tell them that it won't actually benefit them in terms of quality of life
right.
by doing the surgery. It's just to make sure, it's just to stabilize the fracture, but they're not going to regain any motor function.
Right, right.
So it depends. Like,
are these mostly car accidents?
No, actually, a lot of them are falls. A lot of them
Jesus.
Are falls, and they're osteoporotic to begin with.
Yes,
and it
yeah.
doesn't take a lot to just have an hyperextension, and they just piff their, yeah. But I think that 65 or above, those are the ones that where, you know, I really don't know what to say to them sometimes
right.
because if they had a great quality of life and they were totally independent, it usually makes it easier because like they're going to lose all that. But if they didn't, they're already, you know, not great to begin with, then it's harder to sell because they're like, well, we were fine, you know, living in this nursing facility and
right,
like, you know, it wasn't moving much anyway, so it won't make a difference.
It's like
so,
a gradual
yeah,
you know, loss of everything.
Right. I mean, I just recently had a patient who we ended up stabilizing the C-spine and he really hasn't regained much in their function,
mm-hmm.
but to his wife, to his son, and even to him, I don't think they regret that decision.
Right.
You know, the problem is that emotions are running high at time zero, right?
Yeah.
When the injury just happened. So it's really hard for them to really have any clear thought of like, you know, any reason really, because you're just letting emotions really dictate what you're going to do, and which is understandable. And I totally get it. And a lot of times, family sometimes just need that. They need to feel like they did everything, and that includes, you know, doing an unnecessary operation at times.
Well, and especially if the patient's able to participate, at least in a C-spine, they can weigh in.
Yeah, that's
better. It's interesting that we don't see much of that in neuro.
Right.
The other issues I was thinking about is that we're talking about catastrophic bad news, of course.
Sure.
But sometimes I sort of flippantly say, and I think it's true, that one of the worst things I tell people is that they can't drive for 6 months after they have a seizure.
Oh, right.
And we have to deliver news like that. And sometimes that is received as that is the worst thing I've ever told them. And you're not really seeing it that way. So I think there's another question is just like, what is bad news? You know, like I think I was talking to a medical student having to do the OSCEs or whatever the practice,
yeah,
you know,
mm-hmm.
things are where you have to deliver the bad news that somebody had diabetes. And that seems almost like so common that is that really delivering bad news?
Right.
But yes, I mean,
right,
I guess
right.
it is.
Right.
But I don't even think about things like the routine things like, well, yes, you've just got epilepsy now or you've had a stroke. Like that seems not even like bad news
right.
almost, you know?
Yeah, we take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, some of the things we say to patients sometimes, like how much it could really affect them or like if they're highly functional and they have, you know, a job, their family depends on them and they're the money, you know, the breadwinner. Like these are things we don't think about. You know, bad news means something different for everybody. Really.
Yeah. I mean, to some, you know, even hypertension, now you have to take a medicine every day.
Right.
And, you know, I was kind of like, but I don't want to take medicine.
Right. A lot of trauma patients have chronic pain, and that's something they have to live with. Mm-hmm. And then they have, we don't even talk about PTSD and how, you know, rampant that is amongst, you know, my patient population and how that affects them really permanently. I mean, for many of my patients, they have permanent disability, you know, especially these TBI patients as well.
What about when we have to break bad news or, you know, in the face of uncertainty? And that is sort of what we've been touching on.
Right.
But basically, there are times when it's obvious that's easy. I mean, it's not ever easy, and it's always affecting to witness families processing this. You know, it's always emotionally challenging to do that, to see families suffering with, you know, some kind of catastrophic thing. But what is really challenging is when there is uncertainty. You know, when you're saying, well, I don't know, he could recover to some extent in 6 months. He won't be normal. It will be, you know, a limited recovery, prolonged and incomplete. And they're trying to be like, but what does that mean? And it's really, it's hard not to get too specific sometimes,
right.
But it's, we can't.
I try to spin it in the surgical palliative care world. We do the best case, worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the best case might be trach peg and living in a facility for the rest of their life. And worst case scenario is that they die. It helps them kind of gives them a better barometer of like what to expect. But then, you know, there's a lot of it that's great as well. And I'm very forthright in saying that.
Yeah.
I think one of the worst things you can do is like be 100% convictive about like what you're going to predict, because we can't predict anything.
No.
I mean, I think you have to be honest about that. And most people know that. You don't need to Google that, like the unpredictability of medicine, you know?
And then anytime you seem too positive about your predictions, they'll say, well, I had a family member who was told they'd never walk, never talk. And that's who drove me here today or whatever.
Right. You do have those.
Yeah.
And I think you have to also factor in, you know, religious, cultural backgrounds, right? And their belief system, and everyone's different. I think vast majority of my patients are appreciative of being direct, honest, and forthright. I mean, I haven't had somebody tell me like, why were you so honest with me? You know, most people are very appreciative of just no sugarcoating, no BS, like no false hope. I mean, most people, not all, are appreciative of that approach.
I think everybody's appreciative of that. But I think what happens is they see it as a little bit of hubris, thinking, well, I know you think that and you think you know that, but you don't know.
Right.
And they're able to use that. And that's not unreasonable.
Right.
You know, we don't always know, but that can be a hard thing to have a conversation around, especially if it's like, you don't know because the Lord can do whatever.
Right.
And then you're kind of like, well, I don't know how to respond to that.
I don't think that you can change someone's faith or belief system, and nor should you.
Nor should you try.
Yeah, nor should you try. I think that, you know, if they want to grasp onto any false hope they can get, they're allowed to do that. And I think it's just important to remove yourself from the situation and not let your ego get, you know, insulted when they don't believe you, because it is what it is. You can't change them and you don't have control over that. And you just have to walk away. And you also just have to support them, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're grasping for straws, and I'm not going to give them the straws, but at the same time, I'm not going to vilify them for not believing me either.
I have clinged to the idea that I don't want to even bring up the subject of organ donation, like in the catastrophic cases. And that can be something that families find very hopeful, of course. At some point, thought to myself and read, you know, that it can also, in the worst case scenario, be perceived as like a conflict of interest, like the medical system wants this family's organs, you know, and then hence that would bias me against his prognosis or whatever. So I just leave that. I just say, you know, look, once I've declared this person brain dead, the organ donation people, that is up to you. It's nothing to do with me. I don't know how it works. You know, I just basically say something to that effect, like, I'm not the person to do that. What's your approach with that?
I don't bring it up.
Yeah.
I don't even
Do you
bring
feel
it
the
up.
Same way? Like, do you not want to have that conversation?
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah,
I was always taught not to have that conversation.
Right.
That it really shouldn't be between the
reason.
Provider. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a conflict of interest. And, you know, there are times where we have catastrophic brain injury patients that we support because we can't find family.
Right.
But in the back of our mind, somewhere deep down inside in our subconscious, we're also thinking, well, maybe they can donate some organs. Like, you know, turn a tragedy into something good for the world, you know. But I don't think that should be the overarching, you know, governing body of like why we do what we do. But in the back of our minds, I'm sure it's somewhere there. I just don't talk about it ever.
I just find myself always frustrated by it because feel like it makes a death into something like prolonged and sort of not a nice ending. I mean, right? It goes on. It's like I come out and I say, all right, you know, this is official. This is the time of death. I've just done the apnea test. It's done. And then 2 days later, there they still are. Everybody's loitering around. But I think it does matter a lot to families. I think they're very grateful to know, you know, that organs helped another life and stuff. So it's very important. But in my heart, I kind of just feel like a little dread about the whole process, you know?
Yeah, I can understand where you're coming from about that. Because I will say that I think that when you're not, when it's obvious, when the patient's loved ones are having a difficult time accepting the news, it's probably a good thing to get palliative care on board early on rather than wait. Because that's what happened with that one patient I mentioned before, is that they waited pretty long until they got them involved. And the family just ultimately needed more time. But I think that we could have done a better job by engaging them early on, because really they're the ones who are going to be building that emotional rapport with that family and like taking that time more than we can, because we're just
and
so
they
busy.
Help us like even knowing the dynamics in the family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times don't have time to go through all the dynamics or why, you know.
And you've been talking to somebody at the bedside, but it turns out there's, you know, an adult child that lives somewhere or whatever. Right. And so.
Well, it's usually the strange ones that have the hardest time, right? Because they have this conflict of like, unhashed, whatever it may be, whether it's a grudge, whether it's like unfinished business. They feel the most guilt trying to quote unquote let go or.
I do. I find that too. I think those are often the times when they are going to be the most reluctant to call it.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is, you know, we tend to use euphemisms like pass away, transpire, or move on, or whatever it may be. And we avoid the words of death and die a lot. And I'm guilty of this myself from time to time. And sometimes you just have to be really direct and succinct about them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably a favor.
Yeah, absolutely. Because then they're like, wait, like there's hope, you know, because I think you just have to be very, very clear, and especially for patients and for the patient populations who don't have any medical literacy.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy for them to get confused about what you're saying to them.
Well, and that's why sometimes I feel that it's not the right thing to be asking patients' families about what to do. But, you know, I think we've overcompensated for a patriarchal system in the past where we just made summary judgments about the quality of any life and did things without consulting family. But I think we've swung too far, you know, that now we need to sometimes say, I mean, when it's clear, there are times when we need to tell the family, this is not tenable.
There are sometimes I do agree with you that this pendulum has just swung way too much into the patient's autonomy arena, when they really look to us to help them guide their decisions. And so oftentimes they'll say, what would you do, doc? You know, and it's like, we have to insert some level of like our, you know, understanding and our medical knowledge and help them guide them basically.
Yeah. Like our values and stuff, which, you know, I guess that's where we're sensitive about having different values and respecting different values.
Right.
But there are times I sometimes have likened it to like an airplane going down. If the pilot came back and said, now, okay, we can either, you know, do A or B, which would you prefer? We can go down fast or slow. You know, it's like, you know, you just tell me what to do.
Right.
You know, I'm not a pilot.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think of like the code status, like same thing. It's like, it seems so ridiculous to me that we ask patients, like, if you're dying, would you want us to bring you back? Like, what kind of asinine question is that? Like, really? Like, what are we asking here?
Right.
Who in their right mind would say no? I mean, like, really?
Right.
And it's like, that's not really the question, right? The question is, when it's your time, would you want it to be peaceful or would you want it to be violent?
Yeah.
Like, that's a better way
and
of
especially
asking
when you know that the odds of recovery, if they're already older and frail.
Exactly.
Like, what are you, you know, even if you survived, you're not going to get back to where you are now, which is
I think that's how you have to phrase it. It's not a matter of bringing you back, it's about bringing you back to quality of life, basically.
Yeah.
I think you have to frame it for them so that they understand what you're asking.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Prognosticating is a continually humbling process to participate in. And I imagine most of us have had the experience of telling families that a patient will not recover or vice versa, only to be proven wrong down the line. And there isn't much in the way of ancillary testing to help us with it. Things like EEG, MRI, SSPEs. The way they really help, in my experience, is by buying time. And speaking of time, that's about all we have today. But there is more to come now that school is back in, and so is the Secret Life of Neurohospitalists. If you have questions or comments about our show, shoot us an email at secretlifeneuro@gmail.com. And don't forget to like, rate, and share this podcast.